Hey there, everyone. Thanks for listening to Limited Engagement. I'm your host for the show, Jared Duran. My guest on this episode is Kevin Costello, who, along with his wife, Claire, own The Ranch Mine, which is an architecture firm based here in Phoenix. I'll get to that in just a sec. I don't know how this is going to go. I'm going to do my best to just kind of plow through this, but I don't know. Let me, before I completely lose steam here, go ahead and talk about our sponsor, which is Phoenix Film Collective. It's phxfilmcollective.com. If you go there, you will you can get tickets to their showing this week, Thursday, February 13th, of Harold and Maude, the classic film, with a special feature of a couple of the people involved in the making of the film will be there to talk about it. This is at the Third Street Theater for Phoenix Center for the Arts, 7:30 p.m. You can get your tickets at phxfilmcollective.com. And yeah, so I don't know. I'm not gonna be able to process any of this right now. At this point, I think I'm feeling kind of numb. I think that I'm getting used to this pattern now, I guess, I don't know. I just feel like kind of an idiot. And it's like I set myself up for this shit all the time. And, you know, I think I've been trying to not talk about what, I don't know. Just like as soon as I think things are going well and I start to relax, the rug gets pulled right out from under me and I'm getting really tired of it. So we'll see how I kind of process through this over the coming weeks. You know, few good things start to happen. You know, get the column for the New Times, and that's great. There are a couple other things in the work, you know, works. That's how that's said. A couple of other things in the works. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy thing, I guess, right? Just like the better things get, the more anxiety that I get about it, you know, just waiting for the other shoe to drop or whatever metaphor you want to slide on in there. And it inevitably does. And, I mean, I don't know how I'll feel about it tomorrow. I don't know how I'll feel about it later today. I got to get this put up because of some, I don't know, need to stick to some sort of schedule. So this is the time at which I am doing this intro, and this is what you get this week. So none of you know what this means, but I'm never offering to fix anything for anybody ever again. That's, you know, it was a coffee table, but I think I mean that in not just necessarily a concrete fashion like that. I don't know. That's where I'm going to leave it this week. Sorry to be so cryptic. I just don't know. I don't know how to talk about any of it right now. Because it's still too fresh. But again, I got to get this shit done. So, Like I mentioned, my guest is Kevin Costello, definitely not Costello. We cleared that up right away. Kevin Costello. Again, he and his wife, Claire, started about 10 years ago, architecture firm called The Ranch Mine. And you can go to theranchmine.com and learn all about the many awards they've won for their design work. They do some really cool stuff, and you can check out their portfolio on the site. It was a really interesting conversation. I haven't talked at length to an architect before, and I learned a lot. And it was a really good conversation. Had a nice time, and let's get on into that to where where I was in a much happier mood. And I'll just talk briefly on the other side. I did Claire was not able to make it to the taping for this, so it's just Kevin. But I did interview Claire as well, and you can read the interview with the two of them, the story I wrote for Java Magazine. It's in the February issue. And that is available in many places. So you can pick up a copy of that there, or you can go to the Java Magazine website and check that out. But yeah, here's my conversation with Kevin, and hope you enjoy it. But that's got to be an advantage to working out of your house, right?
Yeah. So the great thing is my wife can kind of work when she's snapping, and then I can come in during the day to help out or just to see her and stuff like that. So that's nice.
Gotcha.
So I like that.
Do you have like a separate office
or
something?
We have a house, and we added an addition to it when we knew we were having a baby. And we have an office that's connected to the house, but you can only access it from the outside. So like our employees come in through a side gate, come into the office, and they never have to go into the main house. Mm-hmm. So like I basically walk out a door and then in another door to get to the office. So it's separate but connected, which is nice. So like I'm there in 1 second, but you're not like when you're done with the day, you lock it up, come inside, and you don't have to like see your stuff.
You can still leave it behind.
Exactly. Yeah. So
well, that's nice.
Yeah.
And did you design your home?
Yeah, we renovated it. We bought it in 2009. I don't know. We could talk about this potentially on the
yeah.
Oh, okay. So basically we bought it in 2009. It was a foreclosure. Mm-hmm. And we were basically just looking for a place to live at the time. And so we bought it, we renovated it. We were there for 9 years, and then when we found out we were having a kid, we knew we had to add more space.
Gotcha.
And so we just redid it a year ago.
Okay.
So
you've been in the same space for about 10 years then, yeah.
Yeah, I moved to Phoenix in 2009, and we got this place in late 2009, so it's been 10 years.
You started on the East Coast?
Yeah, I'm originally from Connecticut, mm-hmm. and I went to school, college in Boston, and then I moved out here after that.
So I was reading a little bit about just basically what you had on the site, mm-hmm. and so I mean it mentions your dad was a civil engineer,
and yes.
Like what does that actually entail?
So he was a civil engineer by training. He actually didn't do civil engineering. He worked in it for a little bit and then got out of it because he didn't like it that much. But basically, it's more ground type stuff. Roads, bridges, sites. We work with civil engineers in our projects and that kind of stuff. But it's a similar kind of training in that it's, he actually designed the house that I grew up in.
Oh.
They still live there today. That I think was some of the first exposure that I got to architecture was... Mm-hmm. Literally, the plans of our house were on the wall where I saw, where I'd eat every meal. I could look up and see the plans, since I was, 0 years old. So that was, I think, the first introduction into that and a similar kind of mindset, but also different,
Gotcha. Well, and that, what actually,
drew you to architecture? Is that, were you interested in art and drawing and that sort of thing to begin with?
It's kind of funny. There's a recording of me and even a book my mom sent me the other day with a little inscription that said to our budding architect when I was like 4. Mm. But then I went away from it for a while. So when I was young, I loved playing with Legos and doing all that kind of stuff and just trying generally creative kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I went into it. I did a lot of sports and that kind of stuff growing up. And honestly, I didn't even take art classes in high school. Because we had the choice of doing art or music. Mm-hmm. And I chose music in high school.
What'd you play?
I actually did singing.
Oh, okay.
So I didn't do any art in high school, which made it difficult to get into certain colleges for architecture because I didn't have an art portfolio. So fortunately, the school that I went to didn't require a portfolio to get into architecture school. It's more your SATs and grades and that kind of stuff. The moment that I sort of went back to architecture was I was in ninth grade geometry. And there's a test on proofs, which is part of sort of a math that works its way backwards from a final point. Mm-hmm. And I aced the test, and almost everyone else in the class failed. And my teacher had everyone redo the test, but she brought me aside and said, look, this is something that architects, this type of thinking that architects do. Have you ever considered becoming an architect? Mm-hmm. Which was like, again, it had been years since I had ever even spoken about it. And that sort of just re-triggered that thought in my mind. I thought maybe I'd go into engineering because I was pretty good at math. And because I wasn't doing art, I didn't really think too much about architecture. But when she mentioned that, I, you know, started to reevaluate it. And then by the time I was a junior, senior applying for colleges, I knew that I wanted to do architecture.
And what kind of training is that? It looked like you have to get a couple of degrees there.
Yeah. Well, you need, in most schools now, you need a master's degree. Mm. There are a few schools, University of Arizona is one of them, where you can do a 5-year program and get an undergraduate in architecture. That's sort of being pushed away. Mm-hmm. So you basically need a master's in architecture. Then you need roughly 3 years of working experience. They call it... used to be called IDP, which is like intern development program, and now it's something slightly different. And then you have to pass 7 exams to get your license.
Okay.
So it's, in terms of time, it takes a long time. Mm-hmm. It's usually roughly 6 years of school and then 3 years of work and then a year or two of testing. So it's not too dissimilar from a doctor or something like that in terms of the amount of time it takes to get
gotcha.
Licensed as an architect. Yeah.
And you don't have to deal with bodily fluids, so
which is a
you know,
benefit, yes, yeah, for sure.
At least until you had a daughter. So.
Exactly. Now that's all I deal with.
But I'm curious. So I obviously, you know, I think when I was like 6 years old, architect was on the list, sure. Right? I don't know because I also loved Lego, but mm-hmm. There's certainly an arts aspect to it with the drawing and everything, but there's also got to be a pretty heavy math background into it as well. So can you kind of walk me through,
sure.
just as you're the only architect I've ever interviewed,
sure.
what you know you have, what kind of combination of disciplines you have to
sure.
explore for that?
There is some math and there is some art. I think the general architect is definitely one of those things where it's a job that I think a lot of kids and even parents when they're younger kind of push their kids towards. It's a nice sounding job and mm-hmm. it's a little bit of both disciplines. In reality, it's not much math and it's not a ton of art, to be mm-hmm. honest. What it really is creative problem solving. And so yes, math and, you know, art help that. Mm-hmm. But what it really is, you're trying to come up with solutions to spatial problems. And so I think if you have an artistic sensibility with maybe even sculptural and that sort of three-dimensional art, that's helpful. The drawing mm-hmm. aspect, I think, was something that was more prevalent back when you actually drew drawings. Now it's all on the computer.
Like AutoCAD. And
exactly,
like
AutoCAD,
that.
SketchUp, 3D programs, that kind of stuff, Revit. Mm-hmm. So you don't need to be a good drawer anymore. Mm-hmm. It used to be a skill that you needed, right? If you look back at, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright and people in those days, they hand drew everything. So being an artist was super helpful. Mm-hmm. Now you're more of a digital artist, which is a different skill set. And then in terms of math, you need to know you need to be pretty good at math, but honestly, it's more geometry and just simple equations. Most of the heavy math is engineering.
Gotcha. Okay.
So you need to be aware of it, but you don't need to be the one who's actually doing a majority of it. So I think that's sort of where the typical misconception lies in what an architect's general skill set is. So I think that's creative problem solving is basically what it is.
So did you have to make models and things too?
Yeah, and in school, I don't know what they do anymore. It's been a few years since I was there, but we had to do what they called manual representation, which was drawing in 3D models and that kind of stuff more in the early part of our schooling. And then you sort of move into computers and digital drafting and digital 3D models and stuff later in college. I don't know if they've phased out the 2D, physical model making and 2D drawing, drafting anymore, because not many people do it. It's incredibly time consuming. Everything is pretty much on computers now, for the most part. I mean, there are sure some people still do it, but I think it's more of a hobby type thing than. I don't think many people are building, huge physical models of stuff. It's so time consuming to.
Do you ever find yourself doing that just for fun?
No, but I think I got scarred from architecture school in terms of the amount of labor and long time it takes to build that stuff that I don't do too much of it anymore. And I was always more into the digital stuff anyway. I loved, video games and that kind of stuff growing up. And it's not too dissimilar, versus a SimCity or something like that, where you're building stuff in three dimensions on a computer and flying around. It's I think, more fun than cutting and gluing and all that kind of stuff.
Gotcha. Now, Did you do your intern years out east, or did you do that here?
I did a high majority, about 90% of them out east.
Okay.
And then about 10% here.
And then what drew you out this way? I mean, that's a big leap from, I don't know if how close knit the Phoenix design community is, but I just had interviewed Ashley Harder.
Yeah, I know her well.
And she also came from out there and just kind of settled here on a whim almost. So
not too dissimilar from me. I worked at a few jobs in Connecticut and Boston. And I felt that the built environment there was largely done, that we were making small improvements and that kind of stuff. But they've been building there, in a European style for 300-400 years. And so a lot of it was just sort of very conservative in terms of how they do stuff and not much experimentation.
Okay.
And then I had a professor who had gone to ASU and worked out here with a very well-known architect out here for a while. And he said, you should look into what these guys are doing out in Phoenix. And I looked into some of the architects out here. Wendell Burnett was the guy he was referring to. And then Rick Joy down in Tucson and Will Bruder. And was looking at their work, and it was almost alien to me from where I grew up, but super exciting in that they were basically creating an architecture for the desert of the Southwest. So that was really interesting to me, and I knew I wanted to change. And so I did a lot of research and kind of looked around the country at sort of where development and people were moving and all that kind of stuff. And I just sort of settled on Phoenix, and I decided in my senior or my master during my master's that I was just going to move out to Phoenix when I graduated. I had never been here. Closest I had been is I visited a friend in Las Vegas, and we went to the Grand Canyon from Las Vegas.
Gotcha.
And I thought it was really beautiful out here, but I had never been to Phoenix. And then I graduated and just got my car and packed up everything and drove out here.
Very different from the Grand Canyon.
Yes.
And that's one of the great things about living here, really, is that just you go a couple hours north and you're, in Pine, if you want.
Exactly.
To be. So,
yes.
So from that point, so you're out here in 2009 then?
Correct.
And you meet your wife.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems like one of those very improbable things. You're out here at the time, it's kind of at the lowest point where everybody is losing their homes. Yes. And the economy has tanked and then kept going down for a little bit before coming back up. And here you are with a skill set that people need to have money for.
Right.
And all of this kind of coalesces at the same time. Can you kind of walk me through how that happened and how you managed to make it work?
Yeah. So it was definitely very difficult. The recession was a sort of a gift that we didn't know at the time. Mm. And I'll explain that later. But basically, we were both looking for jobs. So I came out here and a friend of mine from my hometown was moving here as well. Just sort of worked out that way. And he knew Claire from college in Denver. Mm-hmm. And so he said, oh, I have a friend that is moving back to Phoenix from Denver. We should hang out. And so that's how I met her. I actually met her on the first day that I moved out here.
Oh, excuse me.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And so we were both unemployed, just out of college, you know, days out of college, basically looking for work. Mm. And I was applying to every firm in Phoenix and Tucson and Prescott and everywhere around here to try to get a job. And everyone was like, not only are we not hiring, we're not going to be hiring for years because we've let people off that we like. We told them we'd hire them back. So not only does the economy need to get better to hire people back, but we need to get through all those people before we would then hire you. So it got to a point, you know, a few months into the summer, I moved out here in May, in July, August, when I was like, look, I don't even know if I'm going to get a job out here for years. And that's just not obviously sustainable.
Right.
I had had some money saved up from when I had worked in Boston and in Connecticut. And my wife, Claire, she was also doing the same thing. She's not an architect. She was a English and communications major. She was not knowing quite what she wanted to do. She thought maybe she might go to business school, had a few different ideas. But she was temporarily living at her parents' house and wanted to get out. And I had a 1-year lease that was going to come up. And we said, well, the housing market is so low right now. What if we were to buy a house as basically a business type thing where we could live there and, you know, rent out a room and, you know, there was rebates at the time and that kind of stuff. And mm-hmm. so we bought a really inexpensive foreclosed house and started to just redo it for a place for us to live. It was super early in our relationship. Most people thought it was a terrible decision.
Yeah, I've been there, but yeah.
Yeah. And our look at it was, well, if we don't work out, then we had an agreement, you know, what happens with the house and such.
Okay.
So we were looking at it from a business type of thing first, and then obviously it worked out for us. But and then I had a former roommate from Boston who was going to come to ASU for graduate school. So it's like, okay, we can rent out a room to him. That will help with our mortgage payment, that kind of stuff, while we are trying to find jobs still. And so we did that. And then I decided to send that, what we did, we renovated the house. We did all, you know, we were at Home Depot every day. We were YouTubing videos on how to do stuff. I'd never physically built stuff before. She hadn't really either. Sure. And we were doing most of the labor ourselves. And we redid our house. And I said, you know, let's just send it in to the paper. Maybe they, you know, might publish it. Mm. And again, this is that time when papers were more relevant, let's say, than they are now.
Yeah, it took a quick turn.
Yes. And so, so I sent it into the Arizona Republic, and they were actually doing a story on bathroom remodeling.
Okay.
And they're like, we like your bathroom. Was it done inexpensively? And we're like, yeah, incredibly inexpensively. Oh. And so they decided to write an article on it, and it was on the front page of the Arizona Republic. And from that, I had threw together a little website. We had come up with a company named The Ranch Mine, and thrown together a terrible website. And but fortunately, our phone number was on there. Mm-hmm. And from that article, we started to get phone calls from people saying, hey, would you remodel my bathroom?
Gotcha.
And then from that, it was like, oh, maybe my kitchen, and then maybe my, you know, kitchen, living, dining area, that maybe we throw an addition on our house. So it just sort of, and this is over years.
Mm-hmm. But it started ramping up.
It started to ramp up from that, yeah.
So you guys do have this explanation of the name on your website, but for me, it's a little unsatisfactory. So if you can, sure. You know, because it's not something that rolls super easily off the tongue, but it's definitely memorable. So mm-hmm. it's kind of like one that sticks in the head, like, okay, it's The Ranch Mine. So is The Ranch Mine, or is it a combination of a ranch and a mine? Or so, yeah, can you kind of go over that a little bit?
Yeah, it's a little bit of everything. So when we were looking for jobs out here, we were also traveling by car around Arizona, mostly because I had never been out here and I wanted to discover Arizona. Mm-hmm. And it was fun for Claire because she got to sort of rediscover things that she had only gone to as a youth. Mm-hmm. And so we were traveling around Arizona, going to just random places like Globe or, you know, things that you would probably not just say like, hey, let's go to Globe. You know, and in Globe, there's this huge mine, and we went in, we checked out this mine and that kind of stuff. And we're going all around Arizona. We saw these ranches and mines and that kind of stuff. And we were looking into the history of Arizona, and which was largely economically created by ranching and mining. Mm-hmm. And so we thought that was really interesting. And then we were trying to come up with a name for a company. We didn't want to be, you know, Costello Architects or whatever studio, because mm-hmm. everyone's name is like that. And mm-hmm. we wanted it to be rooted in sort of where we were. And we also wanted it to be something where our name wasn't the identifier of it.
Okay.
I like the idea of a company being a company, not like I'm a star and then these are the people that work for me kind of thing. I think it's better when you kind of have it all together. It's just my personal opinion. And so we were working on our house, which is a ranch house, and we were in there and we're chipping away and we're finding all this stuff in there. And we're like, we're basically mining this ranch house. We're trying to find the gems of the beauty within mm-hmm. this terrible foreclosed ranch house. And so we're like, that's kind of a fun way to think about it, that we're mining these houses. Mm. And that's where we came up with the idea, the ranch mine. And then on a larger level, we were thinking, well, Phoenix was largely built in the 50s mm-hmm. and 60s, mostly ranches. Right. And so Phoenix itself is almost a ranch mine, like a huge, like if you look at Globe, it's like a copper mine or whatever, right? And then right. You go here, it's kind of like a ranch mine. Everyone's redoing these ranch houses and that kind of stuff. And so we thought it was just kind of a fun, you know, play on that. And
it stuck.
And it stuck. Yeah.
You mentioned that when you submitted the photos of your redesign to the Republic, your mm-hmm. renovation, that they asked you if you had done the remodel inexpensively.
Yeah.
Is that something that you've actually carried in as a philosophy into your work?
Yes. So it's less about being inexpensive and more about providing value is okay. how we really look at it, because inexpensive is always relative. You know, right. at the time, what we were doing really was inexpensive. Now we work in some medium to higher end homes, mm-hmm. But we're still looking for the value. You know, I never like to spend overpay for, you know, tile that you would never tell the difference of. This is $300 a square foot and this is $10 a square foot, you know. Sure. So things like that we're still very conscious about, and we still build, I think our builds go up pretty competitively with some things that you wouldn't expect it to. So I would say we carry that philosophy of trying to be very smart with where we spend money rather than just inexpensive, because that's a very hard line to kind of carry through. But mm-hmm.
What from I guess again another standpoint, as a business standpoint, as mm-hmm. your builds began to ramp up and all of that, obviously you were not doing all the work yourself, so yeah. How does that do you partner with other businesses in Arizona, did you begin to hire more people, or how do you specialize that way?
Sure. So the biggest departure from just our first one is we don't physically build any of our stuff mm-hmm. anymore, other than our house. And like we did one other project, that was it. So early on we would partner up, or, you know, we'd have builders build all of our houses. So mm-hmm. it was just myself and Claire for the first 5 or 6 years. So even as we ramped up just internally, and we always had the mindset of let's live below our means. Let's try to do all this in-house and that sort mm-hmm. of stuff as much as possible. Now, we do partner with engineers and that kind of stuff on the projects as well. But in-house, we didn't hire anyone until we had our first. We started with a part-time employee. Mm-hmm. And that was, time is hard to figure out. Let's just say 4 years ago.
Okay.
And then we did that for about a year. And then we decided, okay, let's get a full-time employee. And that was probably, coming on three years ago in July. Mm-hmm. So 2.5 years ago, let's say. And then now we have two employees.
Okay. You guys at this point, you've done, you know, multi-unit mm-hmm. spaces and much larger spaces. So do you have just a kind of like a go-to, like as far as the construction aspect of it, just people that you're comfortable working with or form relationships with? Or
yeah, we work with a variety of contractors for the builds. Mm-hmm. We definitely have a few that we work with on more jobs than others. But what always happens is clients will bring in, oh, my friend used this person and they really liked him, and we're very open to working with different builders. But I would say, yeah, there's a handful of probably two or three builders who have built a majority of our stuff because mm-hmm. we have a really good relationship with them. We also like the builders who were willing to work with us when the jobs weren't as sort of grand as, you know, you might think they are now when mm-hmm. we're doing smaller jobs and that kind of stuff. You know, when you're doing bigger, better homes and that kind of stuff, everyone kind of wants to work on them. And we really appreciated the people who worked on the smaller kitchen remodels and additions gotcha. And that kind of stuff. And we kind of grew together with some of the builders. So it really depends on the job, but we've probably worked with 20 to 30 different contractors at some point, but there's probably two or three that work on most of them.
Now, as far as the design aspect of it goes, I'm sure there's got to be a difference between how much creative license you have with something like a multi-unit building and a remodel or a new build. How collaborative a process is that with the person that you're doing the work for?
So for a multi-unit building, it's all about the money. Mm-hmm. It's really about how to make the money work because it's a much more of a business transaction. When we're doing single-family homes, it's more emotional and personal. Mm-hmm. So when we worked on some of the multifamilies that we've done, it was really just, you know, we have to keep the budget here, and within this realm, we need to hit these numbers of square footage, bed, baths, that kind mm-hmm. of stuff. And then you can be as creative as you want within those realms, but it's really tight in terms of the margins and that sort of stuff. So you have to keep it really tight. So you can be, I would say, less creative with the multifamily, in my experience. Mm. Single family homes, people are willing to spend more because they're going to be there 10, 15, 20 years, right? So they'll get that value back.
Right.
So we found the other difference is the more projects that you do, the more creative freedom that you get.
Because people see examples of your work and they're like, I loved this house, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's a trust level that's built in. We always say, we found out that a lot of our clients are entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. And it's just something that we haven't targeted them or anything like that. It's just the people who generally come to us. And we think that's because designing something, paying someone to design something that hasn't been done before, right? Mm-hmm. It's new, it's custom. They're not saying copy this, right? It's something new. It's a huge leap of faith.
Right.
Right. Because you're putting down a lot of money and saying, you know, I want a new house and I don't know what it's going to look like. Right. That's a huge leap of faith. And I think that entrepreneurs are people who understand this is the track record of this person. I have the faith and confidence that if I put the right person with the right people, that I can make something special. Mm-hmm. And so early on, we definitely had a tighter rope on what we could do in terms of like, it was more of a, I like these kind of images on the web. Can you create something along the lines of this, right? Mm-hmm. Now people are like, you know, go for it. Like, we trust you. We like your work. We like what you've done. We want something that comes from you, not something that comes from, you know, elsewhere.
Well, that's gotta feel pretty good.
It's fantastic. Yeah. It's a lot of pressure, but it's fantastic. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you've got the press and the awards to back you up at this point as well.
That's helpful. Yeah.
As I was looking at the portfolio you have online, I realized that I used to live near the Canal House.
Oh, really?
That's yeah. Funny. I that would be the where I would run.
Okay.
And so I kind of like saw that going in and was really fascinated by this building approach with the connection. So, mm-hmm. I mean, was that? It's something that's architecturally unique. It's also just right there. It's in a pretty public spot. It's right there off mm-hmm. of 12th Street and very, very exposed to everybody seeing that go in too. So what was that kind of process like to do you just show people the drawings first and like, this is my vision of it, and then just figure out how best to execute it?
So that's an interesting one because that's one of the few, That's the only house that we were the developers on that as well.
Okay.
Myself and my wife, and then the general contractor, Evan Boxwell, who we've worked with before. We teamed up and said, let's do something ourselves, and then we'll sell it, and it'll be... So, because what we found was when you're working for clients, they typically want something somewhat similar to what you've done before, but let's just say 5 to 10% different.
Okay.
There's like a little bit of, I like this, let's go a little bit different, but there's not that big jump. So we thought, well, if we use our own money, we can create whatever we want, and that will allow us to show something different and unique that maybe a client wouldn't. So basically experimenting with their own money.
Gotcha.
And so that lot was just this sort of leftover lot alongside the canal there, really weird shape. It's like five sides, a weird entry. And so nobody really wanted it because you can't put a typical house on that lot because you have 12th Street, you have the canal, you have an entrance from the back, there's an alley. It's a bizarre lot. And so we came up with that sort of courtyard style design with the sort of the two gables and then the connection between, which creates a courtyard. And that's so that there's private space from the canal and from 12th Street, which can be relatively loud.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's where that design came from. And so it was a really interesting process because it was a very public place for that house. There's a lot of people passed by that house.
Yeah, I'm definitely not the only runner who was going
there's people there, and they would shout stuff to us when we were there, and people had a lot of different opinions on that house, and but it turned out really well for us. So
yeah, it's a really cool structure. Because it looks very modern, but there are elements that you incorporated that also keep it very grounded in kind of a desert aesthetic too. Right.
Yeah, we like to draw inspiration locally. Because I think that's, you know, as humans, we're really, where we are in the world really has a large effect on us, including our everyday surroundings. And so if you can create places that seem a little bit more rooted in their place, I think people feel a little bit more rooted in their place. And so we actually looked at San Javier del Bac down in Tucson, the mission. And it sort of has these sort of two large sides with the center area, and then there's a courtyard, and it's sort of this Spanish style way of living, and the elevation compositionally was somewhat similar to that. And so we were bringing some elements of that, but sort of cleaning it up and taking out all the ornament and that sort of stuff, creating a little bit more modern look. But then we have the rusted corrugated metal roof, which is sort of our play on the Spanish tile. It has a similar kind of rhythm to it, but it's cleaner and modern and a better roof structure. And we're using the stucco, and then we're sort of the tan brick and some of the elements that are more typical here, but doing them in just a different way. So there's a little bit new, a little bit old, and kind of mixing it together.
So kind of like, because there's nothing around it that looks anything like it.
Right.
When you're doing a single family unit like that, where you're designing a home for somebody or renovating their home, is what kind of personal restrictions do you put on yourself to, if people are familiar with your work, or fit in with the community, or do something to, it's kind of an opportunity too, I don't know, how conscious are you also in that of making it like as energy efficient as possible and that sort of thing as well?
Yeah, so in terms of fitting in and what we look at is every project is a different case scenario. So we worked in a lot of historic districts as well. So the area that it's in, we study very heavily early on, and we sort of say, is this neighborhood something where we need to be, we look at it like a truck and a trailer, right? Do we need to be the trailer in this neighborhood in which there are already great, there's a great character to this neighborhood and we're just becoming another chapter of that neighborhood? Or is this neighborhood need a truck to pull this neighborhood ahead and give it some character?
And so that other people can kind of come up to what you do.
Exactly. And so we study the neighborhood, and what we're really looking for is this neighborhood something that was purposefully designed with character over time? And you can really tell when you look at a neighborhood. Some neighborhoods were just, okay, it's the 1960s and we got to throw up a bunch of houses for people moving here after the war, right?
Yeah.
And they've been kind of weirdly added onto, typically illegally, over time. And you kind of see this sort of weird thing happening. And those are the areas where it's like, okay, let's put something here that we think is more grounded in this space. And then how we think it's grounded in the space is that we're studying its context, especially its climate, basically. So we're very concerned with energy efficiency and water efficiency and all those sort of things. We typically use mostly desert landscape, unless the client requires grass for some reason. And then in terms of energy efficiency, like that canal house, for example, basically there's really small windows on the east, almost no windows on the west. All the windows are in that central courtyard, basically, or they face north. So it's facing north and south, and we're getting cross ventilation through the house. So we designed in a really sort of passive way. I think I get that mostly from my father, who was an engineer. He designed our home in the early 80s after sort of the energy crisis and was very into sort of sustainable design way before it was called green design.
Gotcha.
So we do design our houses that way. So we shape the house based on sort of the external forces. Mm-hmm. So the sun, right, the light, the noise, the all these things are the factors that go into shaping these houses. And so I think if you shape the house based on its climate and its surroundings, it's more likely to fit in, right? Because that's the way it's supposed to go. If you're going to have passive ventilation to where you're not using air conditioning all the time, or, you know, you're getting great natural light quality and those sort of elements, I think really help to shape a house itself.
Now, so this is just kind of like my, you know, the thing I've thought about for a long time, because especially now as we have all of these high rises going in and that sort of thing. And that, to me, you know, just, I am no architecture major, I'm no science major, anything like that, but it just seems intuitive to me that in a desert, you don't necessarily want to build up so much, you know? Can you just, for my own edification a little bit, kind of talk about, I know that one of the things that holds us back from building down is how hard...
the soil.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it does seem like for conservation purposes and all that, you're looking at lower ceilings, that you're looking at, you know, definitely things that are lower to the ground in some ways. So how, other than just the sheer fact that the soil is so hard and really, you know, not conducive to, I would imagine, in any kind of like cost-effective way, really breaking through and getting down there, what holds us back from you know, maybe, I don't know, doing something to counteract that kind of, it seems wasteful to have to send all that cool air up 10 stories or whatever.
Yeah. So to answer that, there is an efficiency in building vertically. So basically, a single family house has five sides that are exposed to, let's just say, our 110 degree summers, right? Because you get generally you have the four exterior walls, obviously there's sometimes more,
right,
and then the roof. When you're taking into account a high rise, typically you have multiple units per floor, and then you have someone above and someone below you. And so you typically only have one to two walls that actually are against that 110 degree.
Okay.
So there is an efficiency in cooling a building that way. Obviously, if you're doing, you know, all glass and everyone on gets all four sides and that sort of stuff, yes, you start to lose things because you can't shade very well, you know, vertical buildings like that. But to me, the energy efficiency is more comes in the land use, in terms of when you have more density, you don't need to use cars as much. You don't need to use, you don't have as much landscaping. You know, there's other ways that those become much more efficient. In terms of going down, it's really just a cost equation. It's so expensive to build down. So I think there's sort of a balance where we need to have the density in the high rises, and I think mid rises are some of the best, you know, sort of that 4 to 6 story is, I think, is some of the best that you can do, because you still have the connection to the ground and stuff. But we have to think about designing them in a way that's perfect for the desert. I think a lot of times these people that are building these high rises in downtown Phoenix and stuff are coming from Chicago,
right,
and New York and San Francisco and these places that have high rises, and they're good at high rises, but they're good at high rises in cold climates.
Right.
And so I think that there needs to be, a thought process of, you're coming 10 stories out of the ground and you're facing, you know, a sun that's going to blast you 330 days a year with high temperatures. And I don't think they've quite, as a whole, figured that out, with the stuff that's going up in our skyline, personally. Yeah.
Well, what's your general opinion or feeling about the sheer number of these high rise complexes that we've got going up, and going up really quickly? You know, I used it with just within the last few years, I could drive down 16th Street, you know, from a little bit further north and hit all of these places that were not there.
Right. Well, I read something the other day that said like 200 people a day are coming here to Maricopa County.
That's insane.
Which is insane. And that was in the, I think, the 2018 census or something like that. So we need a lot of new places for housing.
Right.
And so I do like that Phoenix is becoming more dense and more urban. I hope that it starts to, that we don't go too fast and that we understand that this is a desert and that we do it in a way that's appropriate for the desert. Mm-hmm. But I do like the trend of going more vertical because we can't continue to just sprawl out into the desert. That's just not something that will be sustainable when we're having 200 new people a day here. Like single family houses out into the desert is not going to solve that. So I think the infill and the going the vertical is generally good. I do have some gripes about some of the, you know, architecture of it, but overall I like the trend of it.
So what, where do you feel like you are in the conversation for that though, as far as, you know, because, you obviously you must be part of the conversation of that somehow, but how do you feel that you contribute something like that, to the community and kind of make that, I don't know, have kind of part of that dialogue over, especially over the last few years as it's, as we've really bounced back and things have gotten really significantly much more expensive again too.
Sure. Yeah. The cost is definitely, an issue, which is primarily labor shortage.
Sure.
Yeah, in terms of how we contribute to it, I think as a small company, we have limits in terms of the size of projects that we can do. Mm-hmm. And most of our work is residential. Almost all of our work is residential, specifically in single family. So our goal in single family is how do we create spaces that, every one of our houses uses less water and energy than the house that was renovated before. Mm. So the existing house that was on the lot, if we add an addition and we renovate and that kind of stuff, what we're creating is using less than actually the smaller house used before through more energy efficient ways of design and building. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of the lots are actually just dirt lots like Canal House. There was nothing there and we're creating, you know, a home there. But in terms of these larger buildings, we're not really part of that conversation because they're generally large firms.
Sure.
That work on those. We just don't have the capacity to work on something like that. I hope that some of the, you know, architects that are working on some of these or some of the developers start to hire more local architects to design mm-hmm. these buildings. And then maybe we could have more of a part in that conversation and what goes up.
What do you feel like, especially, you know, as you know, I've lived here for 25 years now, over 20, almost 30 years. And it's definitely things have become less and less predictable from a climate standpoint. So whether or not, you right. know, people are climate deniers or whatever, it's, or climate change deniers, it's just the physical evidence is right there. Our summers are hotter and longer. And you know, the start and end seems to be more erratic. You know, our wet seasons are more erratic and sporadic. There's definitely a sense of urgency to increasing awareness of this, but there's so much also red tape and bureaucracy in the way. So you've got APS to deal with, you've got the city to deal with, mm-hmm. you know, SRP, all the, like the major companies like that, that also are so rooted in wanting, you know, things to stay very much the same. Mm-hmm. So how, just, you know, obviously everybody at an individual level is limited on what they can really push forward and try to make part of the conversation. But do you find as being part of that community that we're making any headway in that at all?
Yes. Yeah, I think regardless of how people think that climate change is happening or not happening, it's always good to be more efficient and less wasteful with what mm-hmm. we do. And I think that there is a lot of progress towards that. You know, Phoenix uses less water now than it did in 1990. Mm-hmm. We have, you know, multiple 100,000 people more than we did.
Right.
Some of that is due to there's less farming and that's incredibly water intensive. But a lot of it is due to the way that we design our buildings and we live in our buildings. Mm-hmm. And so I do think on an individual level, every person can have a large effect on that in terms of not only how they consume, you know, you could be in an apartment and it depends on how you use your water, your heat, right. your air conditioning, all that sort of stuff. But a lot of it goes into how do you spend your money? So, you know, what happens is at a certain point, a lot of people get to a life where they can start to afford a home or a place of their own. And they're drawn towards things that maybe aren't the best for the environment. There's a lot of big builder homes that will give you a lot of square footage for a cheap price, right? But you're really doing is you're funding more of that when you do that. And people think that, oh, well, I'm just one person, right? But it's, you know, hundreds of thousands of those people making those decisions on a daily basis who are buying less energy efficient homes, less water wise homes, homes that are out in the fringes that, you know, are scraping up raw desert and that kind of stuff. And I think it's the decisions that you make with your money that really shape the way that development goes. Because what's interesting about the real estate industry is the real estate industry is the most sort of like what's the neighbor doing industry that I've ever seen, where it's like your home is valued based on the homes around you. That to me is kind of insane. That, you know, let for example, a canal house, that house gets appraised based on the houses that are around it that are nothing like it. They have zero, you know, they don't have the size, the energy efficiency, the water, you know.
That's so much of those built out in the 70s and all
exactly. Yeah. And it's to compare those two and say, well, because that's $200 a square foot, this is $200 a square foot because they're the same amount of baths and bedrooms is kind of insane.
Rather than focusing on the unit itself.
Exactly. There's not a qualitative appraisal value other than they rate it based on like 1 through 5 is kind of the thing, which is, you know, there are certain homes I'm sure that you've seen that you could say, okay, if that's a 5 and 1 step down is a 4, like the difference is huge between them, right? And no other market really works that way, right? If there's a good, you know, burger, it's going to cost significantly more than a McDonald's burger.
Right. Whether or not they're price right next
doesn't,
door.
Their price isn't dependent on the McDonald's burger price, just because they're both burgers. They both have a bun and patty and stuff. So that's why it's even more important to spend your money wisely when choosing where and how you want to live, because the developers and all that kind of stuff, they go through all the statistics and they'll say, well, people don't care about green homes. They're not spending more money on them. So why should we build them? And that's sort of the sad and difficult part for us to try to get over the hurdle of is if so to answer the question in a long, long way is if you spend your money and the way that you want the future to go, it's going to go that way, but not unless money is spent in that direction.
Well, and the thing is, too, part of it's got to be just, I don't know, what you're used to also, because at least prior to the recession, that was, I mean, everything was being built out, and there were more and more planned communities and more suburbs and all the McMansion crap, and, you know, all of this, it was like this... It was insane, and now at least it seems like it's turning slightly where people in our relative age range, and I'm thinking you know, like late 20s to early 40s, let's say, you know, are at least hopefully being a little more conscious of that, and it seems like we're rather than taking an amount of space as a symbol of affluence, it's the you know, maybe more uniqueness or location necessarily, you know, if people being drawn to the Coronado district or things like that.
I think there's a change in, you know, the roughly millennials and some Gen X age range where it's quality of life and even wealth status, if that's the way that you want to say it, it's more about what you do rather than what you have. I think the baby boomer generation and before, it was what you have. And so the goal was to have more.
Right.
And I think that it's shifted towards, I want to do more. And to do more, you're probably going to, you know, have a lower maintenance home. You want to be centrally located so you're not in traffic all the time. You want to have homes that have indoor, outdoor living so you can, you know, entertain in different ways. So it's really more about doing rather than having. And I think that's a huge shift that's happened generationally and has happened in Phoenix. And that's why I think people are more open to being more downtown, and maybe your neighborhood has a weird home because you don't have an HOA in it and there's weird stuff going on, and people are more flexible and open to that kind of stuff because it's about doing rather than having and controlling that. I think the suburban lifestyle of sprawl was more about.
Now, there's to kind of shift the conversation a little bit to again, I guess more community, and then maybe more specifically the arts community too, because mm-hmm. there's a large component of design and architecture that is involved in the arts. And where so how involved in that are you as well in the sort of arts and culture scene of Phoenix?
I mean, it's a little bit relative. We are friends with a variety of artists, and we've worked on some homes where we've introduced artists to the homeowners to do pieces for their homes. That's sort of our goal is to try to, you know, we actually get a lot of people who hire us from out of state who are moving here. Or wanting to be more connected to Phoenix because they're hiring us because they want a home that is somewhat of an art piece itself. And they're more generally interested in Phoenix as a burgeoning art community. So it starts with the home, and then it allows us to then filter them into the artist community that's here. So that's sort of where we see most of our role in that community. In terms of culture, I mean, I think, you know, our built environment has a huge effect on our culture. And mm-hmm. so our goal is really to do the best possible work that we can do that's the most interesting and the most grounded in Phoenix, and then share it with the world. I always say that, you know, when we do our marketing to reach out to different places to get it published and that sort of stuff, it doesn't lead directly to many jobs for us. What we're trying to do is to create Phoenix as a place that people want to be. When I moved here because I saw work of great people innovating in Phoenix. Mm. And I think that there's a large power to that, if you can get the word out about the interesting stuff in Phoenix, because there's so many articles out there, right, about the sprawl and the lack of water, right, that you see all those, you know, doomsday type pieces all the time. Mm-hmm. We want the reverse. You know, look at the things that they're doing in Phoenix. That's really cool. And so we see ourselves as part of the way to draw people into that. And hopefully that once they're into that and they start to search, as you do, you know, when you find something cool on the internet, you typically kind of just go on a wormhole down it. We're trying to, you know, open that to allow for them to get deeper into the culture and arts that's local here.
What have you guys kind of got on your plate? What are some projects that you've got on the horizon, and what are you the most excited about taking on?
We have a lot of projects right now, which is great, but also a lot of work. So I think we have 25 to 35, somewhere in that range, in design, permitting, construction, different phases. And so there's a lot going on. In terms of, it's hard to say what we're most excited about. Each project has a different challenge. What we're really excited about is it's nice to be in a place to where we're getting some really interesting clients. Mm-hmm. Which allow us to do more and more interesting things. So we're very excited about the opportunities that many of these homeowners are giving us in terms of creating some interesting, unique spaces, and then seeing how that then shapes Phoenix and our culture moving forward. So that's what I'm most excited about. It's a difficult industry, because what I'm excited about now, you won't see for another 2 years. like everything that you see that, you know, just came out or just finished is something that we designed probably 2 years ago.
Gotcha.
So there is a bit of a delay cycle to what you see.
So by the time you actually see it completed, you're already into the next thing,
it, right? So for the example, by the time that, let's just say, that you saw Canal House, mm-hmm. In between the time that we had the design for that and the time that you saw it completed, we probably worked on 20 projects in between then. Mm. Right. So it's a little bit out of your brain by that time. Yeah. And then it's kind of funny, because when you start getting requests, people want to publish it and stuff, you have to get back into the mind frame of where you were 2 years ago when you designed it, which can be a challenge. So it's a little weird in that way, but I'm very excited. I think there are a lot of really interesting people who are starting to push the envelope more in residential design here in Phoenix. And I think that'll only mean better things for our communities here. We're also working on more projects out of state, out of Phoenix, which is interesting as well, from the work that we've done in Phoenix has led to a broader audience, which is interesting. We're doing a few stuff up north, Sedona, Flagstaff, Williams, that kind of place. We're doing a project in Carlsbad, California, and LA. We have some potential projects in other states going on right now. We're getting inquiries from other countries and stuff. So there is, it is interesting how you can work locally and people
do notice. Do you ever see a point of like reaching capacity or
my, yeah, we, I mean, we do talk about that because obviously having a 6-month-old daughter and that kind of stuff,
there's sure, yeah,
certain limits, but for me, we'll grow as much as we get interesting work.
Okay.
So I would never turn down. Well, I guess
having more people interested, you kind of have, it puts you in a position of being able to be a little more choosy of which projects you take on too.
Right. You don't have to take on projects just to keep the doors open kind of thing, right? Right. You're taking on work that you want to do. And that's our real goal from the day one of building it, is that we want to do work that in 20, 30 years, we're really proud of still, you know, not just work to do work. And it's nice to be, you know, close to a point where that's pretty much all that we do now. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't make it feel like work. And we'll grow as a company as much as those projects keep coming. We're not going to turn down a project that would be a super fun project to do just because we don't have the capacity.
Gotcha.
We'd find a way to make it work if it was hiring more people or not. Mm-hmm. So we've just slowly expanded. We don't want to grow too fast and take on too much to where we're missing that middle point. Mm-hmm. You know, we're looking at, you know, it's funny when you study architecture, most architects don't become like who they are until they're 50, 60, 70 years old. You know?
Sure.
Frank Lloyd Wright moved out here. I forget. I think it was in the 70s when he moved out here and he did some of his best work. And so we're looking at it like, you know, I'm 34. It's like, I'm looking at this like a 50-year type proposition.
Gotcha.
And so we're just trying to take one project that leads to the next, that leads to the next, that leads to the next. And hopefully it gets better and better and better.
And what you've had this business for just about 10 years now, right? Mm-hmm. And what have you seen as the biggest, I don't know, kind of like shift in the industry and in the industry as it pertains to Phoenix over that time?
Great question. Well, early on, we were working with, you know, flippers, and there was more of a sort of temporary status to what people were doing here, where it was more of, there are a lot of cheap homes, let's make them a little bit cooler, and then let's sell them at a higher price. Mm-hmm. The largest shift that we've seen is that people want to be here. Mm-hmm. That it's not just because it's cheap, because it's not cheap anymore.
Right.
And I think it's a great shift. I think it's unfortunate sometimes, depending on the timing of now stuff is more expensive. But I think the good thing about that is it's more expensive because people want to be here. You know, and so that's what we really love about it, is when we're talking to people, most of them are like, this is, I'm going out of here, you know, you got to drag me out of this house dead kind of thing. You know, not like, oh, I'm here for 3 to 5 years and then I'm going to sell this home and I'm going to move to a better place or whatever. It's much more long-term. And I think that's what I did like about the East Coast, is that people are there for generations. And because they are, they're so invested in the place. You know, there's a much more of a community and a culture to it because they're there. Or, you know, oh, I know your cousin and that person, that, you know, there's a lot less of the sort of transient nature that Phoenix, I think, historically had. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people roughly our age are staying here because it's a great place to be now. It's headed in that direction.
Yeah.
Where they used to feel like, my wife grew up here sort of similar to yourself, since she was a baby. And, you know, and now she's back here and a lot of her friends are back here. And I don't think that used to be the case. I think people are like, Phoenix, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
Right. And I think now it's changing. And I think that's the best thing that could happen to Phoenix.
Yeah. I mean, I've been out here since I was 10. And so all I knew was like Southern California before that. And there was, you know, it really feels, even though I was, you know, pretty young then, I would go to LA pretty regularly, but those things that I missed as markers of culture, it seems like as the investment, personal investment of people wanting to take root here has this corresponding increase in interest in furthering the arts and culture scene and growing music scene and places to go do things. And it's not all just rows and rows of bars. There's, you know, or all these retail things.
It's restaurants. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We've got really a really great food scene now too. Yep. Art, you know, all that kind of stuff. So absolutely, that's definitely changed over, you know, since I've been old enough to notice it anyway.
I think in the last since 2010, it's changed significantly. I think the recession was really a great thing to happen to Phoenix. I think it reset the dial and people thought more about what they wanted Phoenix to be rather than just churning out how many Chipotles can we put here, right? And I think going back to people are wanting to be here, you're not going to get a return on an investment on something that's innovative or great or, you know, great for our culture if you're trying to cash out in 3 to 5 years.
Right.
You're just not going to. And so people wanting to be here are taking bigger risks and doing better things because of it, because sure, you'll get your payback in 10 to 20 years. But people before, I don't think thought, oh, I want to be here that long. Now they do. And now you're seeing much more, you know, great restaurants and hotels and all this stuff popping up. That's great. And then that then reinvests into the art community, I think. So.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and you get people, you know, who do things. You know, suddenly we're a place where like Meow Wolf wants to go, or the fact that we have now that Wonder Spaces in the in the mall, you know, and that it never would be a place that would have seen something like that in a million years.
Right.
But yeah, it's great. And you know, it's been great talking to you, man. This was a really great conversation. For me, I like I said, I've never spoken to an architect before. So it was a blast. I really appreciate it. Thanks for taking the time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, that's it. That's the show. Thanks as always for listening. Thanks to Kevin Costolo for coming over and chatting with me. Again, that's theranchmind.com. You can check out their work. And you can read that article in Java. If you want to get in touch with me for any reason, you can email ltd.engagement@gmail.com. And you can, I don't know, follow along on social media and whatnot. If you're so inclined, you can rate and review this wherever you listen to it. That would be great. And see you on down the road. This has been a Hoon Waddle production. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not check out one of our other fine podcasts available from hootandwaddle.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or any number of podcast apps. If you'd like to support Hoot and Waddle and get access to an exclusive member-only podcast, receive discounts on merch, and more, go to patreon.com/hootandwaddle.